This book that I've just written is about feminine values and how they're ascending in leadership. The book is entitled The Athena Doctrine, and it looks at the rise of feminine values, where we see the most innovative women and some men who are breaking from traditional structures to be more flexible, more collaborative, and more nurturing. So it's named after the Athena Doctrine, who you may know from their Greek mythology was the goddess of war, but also of civility. She was also the goddess of mathematics, and that's sort of where I come in. I focus on research, and we gathered data from 64,000 people in 13 countries. We looked at it across a wide swath of political, economic, and cultural diversity. We gathered data from Canada to Chile, and from Indonesia to Mexico. But we also traveled around the world. We traveled and met a number of very interesting, iconoclastic thinkers in science, arts, politics, and technology. We also interviewed world political leaders. And I spent time with President Shimon Peres, and he said something to me that I'll never forget. He said, "We're in a new world with many old minds, and the task of a leader is to adapt yourself." Now keep in mind, this is a 90-year-old president who had just come back from Menlo Park, California, where he had spent time with Mark Zuckerberg, and was understanding and realizing that increasingly we live in this social, interdependent, and transparent world. When we looked at our data and traveled, and as we started to uncover this portrait of this emerging feminine leader, we first started to see that there was a lot of concern in the world today across our data. People questioned whether life would be better for their children than their own. They were worried about too much power in the hands of large institutions and corporations. They also worried that they were questioning their empathy of their leaders. 76% of people disagreeing that their country and their citizens are cared for. And what we started to see also is this question of fairness, 76% of people believing that the world was less fair. And what we started to really uncover and see was sort of this dissatisfaction with the conduct of men in their country. Now, first thing to note is that Canadian men must be doing something right, because they have the lowest levels of dissatisfaction. But when you saw it across the scale, what we started to see was not about men versus women. But in fact, if you look at the Japanese data, 76% of Japanese men were frustrated with the conduct of men in their country. Really what this was about were the structures, the sort of political structures, the business structures, the cultural norms, just the way things are done in business. And never does this get more important with millennials. Young men and women around the world, on a number of our questions in this area, had double-digit differences between men over 50. So we got curious about this, and so we designed a study across 64,000 people. We took 125 human traits, and we asked them to classify them as whether they were masculine, feminine, or neither. Now, in the second part of the study, we did the exact same thing, only this time there was no gender involved. We simply asked people, what do we want in ideal modern leaders? And when we modeled the data together, we started to see that the essence of this modern leader is more feminine. Now, I want you to look at this chart. This is looking at a correlation of what 64,000 people thought was ideal leadership. And I want you to think about Lord Coe's speech this morning. You start to see expressiveness, planning for the future, being flexible, being patient, being intuitive. These are all narratives that people believe are sorely lacking in business, politics, and society, and they equate them more to women. Now, at the same time, it was really interesting to us as researchers to see that aggression and pride were the least correlated to ideal modern leadership. So there's a very interesting dynamic here at play, which is that the skills that a leader needs to get the job are not the same skills they need to keep that job. Today is about engagement. It's about working together across supply chains. It's about motivating your employees, and it's about building sustainable companies. And that's where these feminine values come in. Now, it's important to note that all of this happens inside us. People believe that around the world as well. So let's find ways to build those feminine values into the way that we lead. And that was the theme that we saw. We saw sort of these 10 core themes that were guiding the Athena Doctrine as we went around the world. And a few of them are sort of counterintuitive. Let's take vulnerability, for example. We spent time in Berlin with Dr. Ian Mattish. Now, this guy has a PhD in virology from Harvard. And he told me he kept getting stuck in his experiments. But when he went around to his colleagues to ask for help, he was chastised. They said, "Why are you admitting something you don't know?" He was frustrated with that, so he went on to create ResearchGate.org. This is the first social network for scientists. Soon later, nearly 6 years later, he now has 2 million scientists collaborating on 200 from 200 different countries on 8,500 different research projects. And when I asked him what he wants to do with this, he said, "I want to crowdsource a Nobel Prize, where the doctors and the credits run like they do at the end of a movie screen." The other thing he taught me was the importance of humility. He basically said there would be far less failing if we admitted what we don't know in the first place. Now, at the other end of the spectrum is an amazing woman we met in Israel. She's Major General Orna Barbara. Now, she's the highest ranking member of the Israeli Defense Force. And when I asked her how she approached military strategy, she said, from the perspective of a mother. She said a soldier needs to have a broader view than what they see looking through a gun sight. And to that end, she brought women and men into the front lines at checkpoints, and she awarded them awards and medals for actually de-escalating conflict. We also met some very interesting people, and we started to see this narrative that the strongest, toughest leaders were dealing with very difficult challenges around the world, and they got at them with these feminine values. We spent time in Reykjavik after the crisis. And when we were there, it was really interesting to see how a citizen committee, together led by Orna Barbara Johnson, started to reframe life after the financial crisis. There, they crowdsourced a draft of a new constitution by listening and building consensus with people. We also met Maria Ziv in Sweden. Now, Maria had a challenge. She was, at the time, and still is, the director of tourism for the Swedish Tourism Bureau. And they did their own kind of research, like we do here. And one of the things that she noticed is when she did her sample on what people think of Sweden around the world, the top two things that came back were blonde people and ABBA. So this is sort of a challenge for her. She's doing tourism. She thought, you know what, I've got to find a more nuanced portrait of Sweden that I can share with people. So she went to the government, and they got the official Twitter handle for the country. So if you're on Twitter, follow @Sweden. They gave it over to one citizen every week to tweet on behalf of the entire country. So it was a great experiment until some people started saying some things that people didn't really agree with or thought were very nice. But rather than the government stepping in, ordinary citizens retweeted these people back at a submission. So an example of civility and accountability. We also spent time in Peru. It was an incredible time to spend with Gaston Achurio, who was trained here in France as a chef. He's reinvigorating and democratizing Peruvian cuisine. And one of the amazing things that he has done is taken 400 kids out of the favelas of Peru and trained them to be four-star chefs. We also spent time in the UK with Emily Bolton, and she taught me something really important: the idea of winning is plural. Now, in sort of a masculine context, we think of winning and losing as a zero-sum game. What she helped me understand is that there were new routes to winning that were all about patience and long-term thinking. So she runs social finance, which are social impact bonds. And one of the challenges they had is trying to find ways to reduce rates of reoffending prisoners at Peterborough Prison nearby. They figured that if they could lower the rates of reoffending prisoners by 7.5%, private investors would profit. Well, what happened is that private investors, through enlightened self-interest, got involved in training and counseling to help keep these people out of prison. The net effect was the government lowered their costs, less people were in prisons, and private investors profited. We also had a really lovely afternoon in the British countryside with Holly Jones. Now, she is one of the platoons of grandmothers that sew handcrafted scarves and hats for the British startup Granny's Inc. Check it out, it's grannysinc.co.uk. And one of the greatest things about it, why it's become a hit with millennials in the UK, is that the first thing you do is you go onto the website and you pick out your own granny. Now, if you pick out your own granny, she sews a scarf or a hat for you, often with a hand-sewn message of hope and inspiration. The theme line for this startup is, "There's wisdom in the wool," taking an ordinary product and imbuing it with empathy and emotion. We also spent time with Julian and Ming Lee, who are revolutionizing furniture design. They decided that rather than the typical way that we buy furniture, we should actually have consumers come together and collaborate and build their own network. And that's what they do at Made.com. Through trust and through collaboration, consumers come together and work as a voting block to decide what type of furniture is made before the furniture is even developed. And then lastly, we spent time with Eriko Yamaguchi. She was perhaps one of the most famous and favorite interviews of mine that we did. She was a young woman who was bullied so badly in school that her parents actually had to take her out in Japan. And while she was at home, she started sketching. She started to realize that she had this talent for fashion. And she designed handcrafted handbags. So she graduated from a university in Bangladesh after having gone on to Yahoo and typing in what is the poorest country in Asia. Once she got this, she leased a factory in Bangladesh with 115 men. They were all men, most of them were illiterate. She, keep in mind at the time, she was 24 years old. And the first thing she did is she gave them name badges for their self-esteem. The second thing she did is she gave them profit sharing in a company. The only challenge was there were no profits yet to begin with. And the third thing she did is she gave them safe working conditions out of central Bangladesh that would become very prophetic in the years to come. Now, fast forward, 5 years later, she has 7 stores in Tokyo. She pays her workers double the average rates in their sector. And in her own research, 2/3 of people don't know anything about her social business model. They only know that she makes high-end luxury goods that are made in Bangladesh. Now, when we look at why these things are important, we're seeing this collapse of these corporate values, core values that people desire out of companies, and the values that we look for in brands as consumers. And we start to see this Athena principle at play. This is a chart that looks at 3,500 brands in our data. And as you can see with the yellow and red dots, these are brands that either skew feminine in their values, in their Athena values, or they are balanced with masculine values. So we start to see how they're driving usage and preference in brands. And when we get a little bit deeper into your category, we start to see some sort of interesting nuances that are sort of developing here as well. So first we see in the developed markets, the definition of luxury has been remained fairly constant over the past decade. The core attributes are sort of essentially the same, about being high quality, upper class, prestigious, stylish, and glamorous. But yet, when we looked at our research that we just conducted with global elites, and these global elites are people that both travel extensively and also buy premium and luxury goods, you start to see that there's an additional layer of meaning that they're looking for out of their purchases. Not only are they looking for them to be upper class and worth more, they are actually driving more loyalty if those brands are trustworthy, if they're reliable, if they're caring, authentic, and if they're distinctive. Now, what we also see is the rise in these feminine values, these Athena values inside the luxury category. A lot of these attributes in our data are also ascending. So being real, being caring, being reliable, these are all becoming important, dominant impacts on driving brand preference and ultimately loyalty in your category. Now, when we look at the brick markets, though, we kind of see that pretty much the same values that drive luxury are the same things that are in place 10 years later. In a sense, these markets are almost mirroring the markets in the developed world of 10 years ago. So stylishness, upper class, high quality, glamour, being traditional, these are all really, really important still. But what's also interesting to note, though, is that there's been this sort of evolving definition of luxury, where it's moving not just from prestige, but also to experiences. So when we looked at our data in 2003, indulgence, status, belonging to a special club, all of these things define luxury. But today it's far more about personal experiences. It's about that being higher than indulgence, status, and even belonging to a special club. And lastly, I think the really important impact to think about here is the rise of this social millennial shopper. Now, in our data, millennials are so focused on ethics and values of companies that it's really moving their way into their process. But they're also focused on mobility, they're focused on social, and also on really guiding a more purposeful world with the purchases that they make. So look at these stats. 71% of millennials globally would share their social graph in current location when shopping if it made their experiences more personalized and relevant. 68% of millennials would promote a brand to peers for insider access and unique offers. And 58% of millennials globally want to make a purchase with e-wallets, and they get frustrated with what they referred to us in our research as analog stores. So all of these statistics, all of these dynamics are sort of swirling around, but the part I wanted to leave you with is that we have this incredible opportunity to advocate for women and girls around the world by having men model their approach. We are moving into a new era. We are moving into an era that is about a social economy. It's about interdependence in the way that we do business, and it's about transparency. And so I actually reframe feminine values as a source of innovation and competitive advantage. That was my learning from this research, and I'm enormously grateful to tell you that we have donated all proceeds of our book to the United Nations Foundation Girl Up campaign. It's www.girlup.org, which is focusing on minting the next generation of young women leaders. So with that, I thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Take a seat.